We continue our study tonight from the book of James in chapter 4. And we're ready to start into verse 4 tonight in our study. This is obviously built upon the context of what has come before it. I might pause for a second. I think I'm going to be getting the feedback. So in the context of James chapter 4, this early part of the chapter, it's really continuing and building upon what we saw in the latter part of chapter 3, and really going back to the very beginning of the book, of course. There is an overall context to the book, but in particular in chapter 3 at the end of it, there was that contrast between this wisdom of God that we need, which is that wisdom from above, from Him, contrasted with that wisdom that is not from above. And that's really what we see with, how many different things? I think Brother Johnson brought a lesson here recently where we saw a contrast in traditions. There are traditions of men and traditions of God, aren't there? There's wisdom of men, there's the wisdom of God. There's the righteousness of men, there's the righteousness of God. How many different things do we have a set of values or principles or things that are that belong to the world and its ways versus what is of God? There are many of those things, and we have to look at and discern the difference between what is of God and from above and what is of this world. But with those lists of things that are of this world as opposed to what is of God, how similar are they? And that's really the point. What did we see with the wisdom that is of God and the wisdom that is of men? And again, we know whatever is of men is from where, ultimately? The devil. I mean, how many spiritual fathers exist? There are two. There's the father of that, all that is that pertains to what we'll see described so often as of this world. But who is the father of all of that? Of course, that is the devil. All of these things of the world, they're not of God. But all those things that are of Him, of course, they do belong to God. And that's what we need to pursue. That's what we need to seek and need to have. There's no similarity between what is of God, all the things that we could list that are of God with its the opposites that are of this world, which are from ultimately the devil. And I know we all have many times seen or heard Isaiah chapter 55, where God expressed this concerning His thoughts and ways versus man's. Again, which would be following the ways of the devil. But in Isaiah chapter 55, he says in verse 6, "Seek ye the Lord while He may be found. Call ye upon Him while He is near." And does that fit in with what we have been taught in the book of James? What we are to be seeking and doing, hearing His words and doing them, having that living faith that comes by hearing His word and practicing that pure and undefiled religion before Him, bridling our tongues and our whole body, pursuing, enduring all the temptations so that we may be complete and entire, lacking nothing. Well, we need to seek what is God and all that He has, that we may have those things. And we need to seek Him while He is maybe found, and call upon Him while He is near. And doesn't that also suggest to us or teach us that there can come a time when it is too late to do that? We can exhaust our opportunities to seek God, and at that point, and how many people are end up like that man who was rich on this earth that ended up in torment, becoming the beggar there, recognizing that for him it was too late. All that he loved, all that he sought after, and it was gone, and he was entirely unprepared for that world that he now lived in, for that eternity that he belonged to. For him to then try to turn and seek God at that point, could he? All he could do is beg that Abraham send Lazarus back from the dead, so his brothers, while they could have the opportunity to seek the Lord, might do so. And we know what the answer was to that. But what is what does he say in verse 7? What goes along with seeking the Lord while he may be found, and calling on him while he is near? He says, let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. And let him return unto the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him, and to our God, and he will abundantly pardon. So as we're seeking God, what do we have to do with our own thoughts and ways? We've got to get rid of them. And why is that? And there's where we have verse 8. For, and there's the word there that's showing the connection between what he's just stated. We've got to seek God, forsake our own thoughts and ways, as he used both of those words, let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Is there any blending of the two? No. And what have we already seen? What did we see in James chapter 3? When there is that mixture in our hearts of this wisdom that is from above, and some of what is not, as we still have some of those things in our heart that need to be purged out, but as long as they're there, and it's going to produce that the fruit according to it that is not good, and we have that mixture that comes out in our words while we are still growing and have need to purge out those things that are not of God. But what did he say about that? My brethren, these things ought not so to be. Does the Lord accept that mixture if we have what is of him and what is not together? No, and what did we see in chapter 1, James chapter 1? What is that pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father? And that's the latter part of it. And I appreciate you mentioning that first. That was actually the part that I wanted to focus on. But there seems to be a lot of times the pointing out the first part of that, to visit the widows and fatherless in their affliction, which is certainly part of it. But sometimes it kind of seems to stop with that part. Well, we need to do good to the widows and orphans. We do. But how much emphasis is given to that other part there, and to keep himself unspotted from the world? If we have this world's spots on us, then what is our religion? It's not pure and undefiled. So that religion requires, by God, for us to be unspotted from the world. So how much of what is of this world, including its wisdoms, its thoughts and ways, and the traditions, the doctrines, the righteousness of men, how much of that can be in us or part of us, and our being able to please God and practice pure and undefiled religion? Zero. We have to be unspotted from the world. Does that sound like a high calling? And we already emphasized, saw the, what verse 26 of chapter 1 said as an example of practicing vain religion, and that is when we don't have our tongues bridled, which is the hardest job there is. Because when we do bridle it, we're able to bridle the whole body, and that man is the complete man, he said in James 3, verse 2. So how high is God's standard? It is the highest standard. It's that high calling of God in Christ Jesus that we run that race and finish it, that we may then receive that prize of the resurrection of the dead and eternal life. Does the Lord accept partial seeking and a partial running of the race? That he does not. When he says we're to be doers of the word, how much? All of it. All that he's commanded. And so that's the high standard there, but we've got to get rid of, and this is why we should see the very great importance and necessity of turning away, purging out, and getting rid of all of these things that are not of God, that anything that is of this world. Quickly, let's flip over to 1 John, a few pages here from James 4, over to 1 John chapter 2. We've heard verse 15 many times. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. So once more, how much blending can there be? How much can we love the world and still love God? It's either or. We have to make a choice. If we love the world, then we don't love the Father. That's God's own statement there. Well, when he says the things of the world, what is he talking about? Now, there, you ever heard somebody say, well, that's sinful things in the world. Does it include that? Well, of course it does include that. Anything that transgresses God's law, we can't love and practice. But what is it? How does the Lord define it in verse 16 in this very context? Verse 16 says, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. So all of those things, which includes all sinful things, but it includes anything that is not of God. If it doesn't work his righteousness, if it's not to serve him, then what do we need to do with it? We better not love it. We need to get rid of it. Chapter 3 of 1 John, in verse 10, he says, in this the children of God are manifest, and the children of the devil. Whosoever doeth not righteousness is not of God, neither he that loveth not his brother. Making it clear once again, we are going to be a child of either God or the devil. What other option is there? If somebody's trying to find a different way that, well, I don't want, I'm not really a, I'm not, if somebody is saying that they're not really a believer in God, but, well, they don't want to believe in and be a child of the devil either, then what's the other option? There isn't one. I mean, we are either God's child or we're the devil's. I mean, that is clearly defined and stated and taught there in 1 John 3, verse 10. It will be revealed whose child we are according to what we do. If we do righteousness and love our brother, then we're going to be revealed to be a child of God. If we don't, then we're a child of the devil. It's that plain. And when he's speaking about that righteousness there, whose righteousness is he talking about? He's talking about that righteousness of God. Is there a righteousness of men? Do men come up with their own standard or definition of what they think is right? Yes, that's the righteousness of men. Romans chapter 10, verses 1 through 3. This was a problem that the Israelites had in the time of Christ and of Paul. And in Romans 10, 1 through 3, he says, "Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved." Would he need to have such a strong desire and prayer if they already were saved? What does that say about their spiritual condition? They weren't saved. And he was desiring and praying that they might be saved. Verse 2, why weren't they saved? Weren't they God's people? He says, "For I bear them record that they have a zeal of God." Now, the Sadducees were really atheists, but the Pharisees, and this would fall in the realm of what he's describing here, Paul himself had been one, but the Pharisees, they were religious people, weren't they? Did they believe in God as far as what they professed? Did they have allegiance to Moses and Abraham? Did they profess to in any event? They did. But what was the problem? There was a zeal of God in them, but he says not according to knowledge. For they being ignorant of God's righteousness and going about to establish their own righteousness have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God. So there again, there's another one for the list. And in contrast, we have a wisdom of God, wisdom of men. There's this righteousness of God and there's the righteousness of men. They don't mix. They don't belong together. They don't blend together. We have to make a choice. So when we get to James chapter 4, having already seen what he established in the latter part of chapter 3, this wisdom that is from above and what it produces and all of its fruits, how does it compare to this wisdom that is not from above and its fruits? They're opposite. And the problem here is there were brethren that still had some of that wisdom, that devilish wisdom in them, and the fightings and the envying and strife and the confusion and every evil work that it produces was there. And that was that's what was behind the rebuke in the first three verses. They had their heart set on things, their desires that weren't good. They were being taught to turn away from a desire for these things that are not of God, to get rid of that, to seek the Lord. Now he addresses these same ones. He says, "Ye adulterers and adulteresses," in verse 4. Now, these ones, the ones that he's referring to as adulterers and adulteresses, has he changed the subject as far as who this book is written to? Has that suddenly changed? Verse 1 of the book says, "James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, greeting." That's how it started. Now, is he suddenly writing to somebody else? Not these spiritual Israelites that are Christians. And we've seen brethren used so often here. My brethren, as he started chapter 2. And he's still speaking to the same one. My brethren, he begins chapter 3. He's still speaking to the brethren here. Now, does it seem odd that he addresses brethren as ye adulterers and adulteresses? That's a problem. Now, that's the common word for adulterers and adulteresses that he's using there. It means exactly that. Now, how many kinds of adultery are there? Well, there's certainly the physical kind. And that was one of the Ten Commandments, not to commit that. That same commandment is part of the New Testament also. Is that the problem that they had? Is that the context here? That's not to say some of them may not have had that problem with the physical adultery too, but that's not the kind that he's talking about in this context. He says, "Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know you not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God." This context is dealing with spiritual adultery. Well, the physical adultery is when someone is unfaithful in their marriage to their spouse. Spiritually, who do we belong to? When we're in Christ, well, we're a spouse to Him. We belong to the Lord. If we are unfaithful to the Lord, then what are we spiritually then? Then that makes us adulterers and adulteresses spiritually. Very specifically here, what kind of, how is unfaithfulness manifest? Friendship of the world. If we're a friend of the world, then we are spiritually committing adultery against the Lord. And we are then his enemy. Can we be a friend of the world and also, what we saw earlier in this book, back in chapter 2, what did the Lord refer to Abraham as in James 2:23? Friend of God. Can we be a friend of the Lord? What does that require? Yes. Did you make that up? Did you come up with that on your own? No, of course not. That's not written by Caleb or me or any other man. But in John chapter 15, Jesus spoke about how we are to be his friend. John chapter 15 and verse 14 and 15, he says, "You are my friends if you do whatsoever I command you. Henceforth I call you not servants, for the servant knoweth not what his Lord doeth, but I have called you friends. For all things that I have heard of my Father I have made known unto you." Well, he's revealed a friend. Friends aren't hiding things from friends. That's not the nature of friendship. And Jesus wasn't hiding his Father's will from us, his disciples. How could we be Christ's friend if he's hiding from us the things of his Father that we need to know and have? He's made that known to us. We have the responsibility and the obligation, duty, to then do those things. That's exactly what we've been seeing in the book of James. We hear them and we have to do them. And if we do them, he says, we are his friends. So we can be his friend, but being a friend of the Lord requires our doing what he says. And of course, Christ didn't speak of himself. He only spoke what his Father gave him to speak. So he's revealed to us all these things from his Father, everything. That mystery is revealed. How much is hidden from the Lord's children if we seek him while he may be found and call upon him while he may be near and forsake our thoughts and ways and seek after his? How much is the Lord going to hide from us if we're doing that? He's not going to hide those things from us. But if we don't do them, if instead we're a friend of the world, then we're no longer his friend. Now, later in John chapter 15, a few verses down in 18 through 21, there is a cost to being a friend of the Lord. John 15, 18 through 21, he says, as thou hast sent me into the world, whoops, I ended up in chapter 17 there, John 15, 18 through 21, if the world hate you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love his own. But because you're not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you. Remember the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they have persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they have kept my saying, they will keep yours also. But all these things will they do unto you for my name's sake, because they knew not him that they know not him that sent me. Now, if we do come out from the world, which that's what the word church is, ecclesia, the called out ones. We've been called out of this darkness into his marvelous light. We've been called to come out from this world and be separate from him, holy to him. If we do that, which is the requirement of being his child, it's when we do that, we remember 2 Corinthians chapter 6, if we come out from this world, come out from among them and are separate to him, he said, then he will be our father and he will call us his sons and daughters. I mean, that is the basis of becoming a child of God, this coming out from the world. Well, we have to forsake it. And in Galatians 6:16, when Paul forsook it, what happened with him? What was his relationship to the world? He was crucified to the world and the world to him. I mean, there was no friendship there. If you're crucified to something and it to you, is there any friendship with it? I mean, none. So Paul had made the decision to come out from it. And so he forsook it utterly, which is what we have to do. That's a requirement to be a child of God. And when we do that and we are no longer of the world, well, what does the world think of that? And does the world accept us? Will the world accept us to be a friend of Christ and a friend of it too? Well, of course, then we're really not the friend of Christ. But if we do belong to Christ and we're not of the world's not going to claim us. We're not of it. And the world, what is that? Whatever is of the world will love his own. But he says if we belong to Christ, the world's going to hate us like it hated him, because it doesn't know God, the one who sent Christ. And it's for his sake and the Father's sake that we are being hated and persecuted by the world. But being a friend of the Lord then means, what's the cost as far as us and the world? The world's going to hate us and persecute us. But if we're a friend of the world, what did we read in James 4:4? Then we're the enemy of God. Friendship of the world is enmity with God. So what do we do? Somebody says, well, I want to be a friend of everything. I want to get along with every being. I want to get along with the world, and I want to be God's friend too. What do? We have to make a choice. That same choice that's in 1 John 3:10. We have to choose whose child we're going to be. God or the devil? If we're the devil's, then that's being of the world. Who's the prince of this world? Those that are of this world, whose snare are they? Who do they belong to? They're the children of the devil. But if we choose to be God's child, then we can't be of the world. We're either going to be the enemy of the world by being a friend of the Lord, or we're a friend of the world and the enemy of God. Is there any other way? That's the choice. Whose friend do we want to be, and who do we want our enemy to be? Well, if we're wise, we're certainly not going to choose to have God as our enemy. If we're wise, we're going to choose to love our Maker and seek Him and come out from this world and then endure the persecutions that will come from our being hated by this world. But if we're a friend of the world, then we are the enemy of God. Because then we're spiritually an adulterer and adulteress. Because to belong to God, how much of us has to be for the Lord? How much of us does He get? It's got to be all. If we're any part of this world, and we saw there in 1 John 2:16, all that is in the world is not of the Father. I mean, does the Father claim these things of the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, all the pride of life, all that is in the world? He says it's not of the Father. If that's what we love, if that's what we're caught up in, then we will be God's enemy, because then we're not following Him, and that's what would make us spiritually to be an adulterer and adulteress. Going back to the when God gave the law to Israel, the Ten Commandments, it starts with. Where do we find the Ten Commandments in the Bible? What's the chapter that contains the original giving of the Ten Commandments? That's in the book of Exodus. It's chapter 20. That's one of the ones. Hopefully, even our children can learn that. There's some of those ones that are very good to have, at least in our memories of things to find, but. But that's a good one to know, Exodus 20, being where we find the Ten Commandments. And in verses 1 through 6, when the Lord was giving this his law to Israel, as he begins it, and this is after he's had where the mount that Moses was brought up in to get the Lord's commandments, it was on fire. It was altogether a smoke, and it was quaking mightily. And all the people of Israel, when they were seeing and hearing those things, what did it do to their hearts? It terrified them. If we'd been there, I mean, what would we have been thinking? But in Exodus 20, after all of that, and then he's speaking his words to his children, verses 1 through 6 of Exodus 20, and God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. So here's love and hate of God, defined as whether we keep his commandments, or and for the this law, for whether the Israelites kept these commandments or not. But he began with that commandment to have no other gods before him, and to have make unto them no graven image. Those were the first two commandments. And what did God say about that? Why they weren't to do that? Because what kind of God is he? A jealous God. Well, just like anyone who is married, they're going to be have a jealousy for their spouse, that they don't belong to another at all, not in any way. Well, God says that we belong to Him, and He was speaking to His children there, and told them not to have any other gods. Well, what is one of the other forms of idolatry that we know? Covetousness is idolatry. He teaches that to us, Colossians 3, Ephesians 5. And why is that put in the same realm? Well, if we are serving anything, whether it's an idol or whether it's things, the world, If it's anything other than God, then we are giving to all of that is part of the creation. And if we're giving ourselves to anybody or anything other than God, is he jealous over that? Yes. And then we are giving ourselves to another, not the one who made us. And then that makes us spiritually to be guilty of adultery. Exodus chapter 34, verses 10 through 17. Exodus 34, 10 through 17. And he said, "Behold, I make a covenant before all thy people. I will do marvels such as have not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation. And all the people among which thou art shall see the work of the Lord. For it is a terrible thing that I will do with thee. Observe thou that which I command thee this day. Behold, I drive out before thee the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Take heed to thyself, lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land whither thou goest, lest it be for a snare in the midst of thee. But you shall destroy their altars, break their images, and cut down their groves. For thou shalt worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. Lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go a-whoring after their gods, and do sacrifice unto their gods. And one call thee, and thou eat of his sacrifice, and thou take of their daughters unto thy sons, and their daughters go a-whoring after their gods, and make thy sons go a-whoring after their gods. Thou shalt make thee no molten gods." Well, here the Lord is teaching them again what we saw in chapter 20. But look at the language there that he's using. If they go after any of these things of this world, then what are they doing? They're committing adultery by the very language he's using there. And God, he says, whose name is jealous. Well, does he feel any differently about us today and being his children? Can we give ourselves in any way as far as our love and service to anything, any part of this world, of this creation, anything other than him? And the answer is no. There are a lot of other passages in the Old Testament that deal with this issue. One that's we saw a little bit about recently in our study in Sunday morning of the kings, and particularly the King Josiah and what's going on in his time. But the children of Israel have been going after idols. They've been sacrificing their children in fire as part of their idol worship, and filled Jerusalem with the innocent blood of their own children, which, as God said in Ezekiel 16, were not theirs, they're his. They took his children and did that with them. So, of course, the Lord had great fury over that. Josiah came along and brought the people into covenant with God that they would not do those things anymore, that they would keep all of God's commandments and serve him with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength. And they all agreed to it. Why? Yeah, they were out of fear of Josiah. He was, not to say he wasn't worthy of fear with his zeal for the Lord, he was not going to tolerate them not doing that. And as long as he was around, they did that. But as soon as he was gone, what did they do? Including his own children. They all went right after the wickedness. The Lord is speaking about this right here in Jeremiah 3. He's even going to pinpoint this time being in the days of Josiah. Jeremiah 3, 1 to 9. He says, "They say, if a man put away his wife, and she go from him and become another man's, shall he return unto her again? Shall not that land be greatly polluted?" And that's in Deuteronomy 24. That was the law that God gave. It was not. He hated divorce. He allowed them to do it because of the hardness of their hearts. But if you read Deuteronomy 24, 1 to 4, if they did that, and a man put away his wife, divorced her, the law did not allow her to go back to him. And the Lord is mentioning that here. If a man put away his wife and she go from him and become another man, shall he return unto her again? Shall not that land be greatly polluted? But thou hast played the harlot with many lovers, yet return again to me, saith the Lord. Lift up thine eyes unto the high places and see where thou hast not been lying with. In the ways hast thou sat for them, as the Arabian in the wilderness, and thou hast polluted the land with thy whoredoms and with thy wickedness. Therefore the showers have been withholden, there have been no latter rain, and thou hast a whore's forehead. Thou refusest to be ashamed. Wilt thou not from this time cry unto me, my father, thou art the guide of my youth? Will he reserve his anger forever? Will he keep it to the end? Behold, thou hast spoken and done evil things as thou couldest. The Lord said unto me, in the days of Josiah the king, hast thou seen that which backsliding Israel hath done? She has gone up upon every high mountain and under every green tree, and there hath played the harlot. And I said, after she had done all these things, turn thou unto me, but she returned not. And her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And I saw when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. And it came to pass through the lightness of her whoredom that she defiled the land and committed adultery with stones and with stocks. And then the next verse, he says, yet for all this, her treacherous sister Judah had not turned unto me with her whole heart, but feignedly, saith the Lord. They weren't sincere in it. They did it because they were afraid of the king, but they didn't do it because they loved the Lord and they repented in their hearts. But he's describing what Israel had done, the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom, and the Lord had divorced. He had divorced Israel. And what happened to those tribes? How did the Lord display or signify? What did it mean to be divorced by God? Those 10 tribes. They were done. I mean, there was no remnant preserved to be brought back, like God preserved a remnant of good figs from the tribe of Judah in Babylon and brought them back after 70 years. Those ones that he gave hearts to know him. There was none of that with the 10 tribes of the north. Most of them died. Whatever was left was carried off by the Assyrians and dispersed in some different lands that they had conquered. And then they are lost to history from there, known as the lost tribes of Israel. Well, they had no spiritual distinction anymore. They were just like everybody else. And so when they were sprinkled and mingled with all the rest of the people of the nations, that's who they belonged to anyway. And any distinction that they had as being Israelites, God's people, that was gone. So they were finished. And then Judah committed spiritual adultery also. But we see that language God is using over and over again when they were giving their love and service to anything else other than God. That's what he says they were doing. They were committing adultery against him spiritually. A lot of other passages. I'll give you a few just to spend some time on your own in your studies. Ezekiel chapter 23, that entire chapter builds on exactly what was in Jeremiah 23, 1 through 9. It's a 49-verse chapter about the two wicked sisters, Ahola and Aholibah. Ahola is Israel, the 10 tribes of the north that he was referring to there in Jeremiah 3. And Aholibah was Judah, the southern kingdom. But he goes into all the details of all the whoredoms and the adultery spiritually committed by both the kingdoms, all of God's people, and his judgment on them for it. So there's an entire chapter about it, Ezekiel 23. And I made reference a moment ago to Ezekiel 16, verses 23 to 43. And that chapter has some extensive teachings by God and his judgments upon all of that spiritual adultery committed by the Israelites of the Old Testament. But let's turn over to Romans chapter 1, because we can see here what the real problem is. This is not an Old Testament issue that is being something that is confined to or limited or is directly related to the law of Moses and whether they kept it or not. This was the principle, as we saw in Exodus 20, Exodus 34, and those other passages. The issue was, these people belonged to God, and when they didn't give God all of their service, when they gave any of themselves to anything else, then they were committing adultery against him. Well, in Romans chapter 1, let's look at the world in our time, the world in the time of this writing 2,000 years ago, the world in any time. This is going to be the case. In verse 18, Romans 1:18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness." Well, God is angry with the world. Well, what did we just see in James 4, verse 4? The world is God's what? His enemy. Well, is God angry with his enemy? He is. Now, what do we also learn from Matthew 5, 43 through 48? In spite of this wrath that he has, this anger that he has against all of this ungodliness and unrighteousness in this world, what does he still do with the world? He's still feeding and clothing the world. He's still showing his love for his enemies. So he's angry with it, but he still loves them. Well, if that weren't the case, we'd have an empty room here, wouldn't we? But God's wrath is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. And there's this particular truth that we've gone over a lot of times that he's referring to. Verse 19, "Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them." So that truth that they're holding in unrighteousness is this truth, that which may be known of God. It's something about himself that he's made known to everybody. And he tells how in verse 20, and also more about what this truth about him is. It's the invisible things of him. "For the invisible things of him," how is it revealed? "From the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made." What is that truth that he's revealed through the creation, made known to all men, where it's clearly seen by everybody? He says, even his eternal power and Godhead. That's that truth, that which may be known of him, those invisible things of him. And that word Godhead, that's his divinity, his divineness, his godness. Well, who he is. His existence and the fact that he's God, that we have a God and he's it, and he's eternally powerful. Is that demonstrated by this creation, that there is an almighty, all-powerful, eternally powerful creator who made it all, including us? That is revealed to everybody, which then in verse 21, or the end of verse 20, he says, so that they're without excuse. Who's without excuse? And who are they without? What, and there's no excuse for what? Well, who's without excuse? Everybody. Everybody's included in this. Who knows? Who's holding this truth that there is an eternally powerful creator that made us? We're all holding that truth. Now, the issue in verse 18 is, how are we holding it? Are we holding that truth in righteousness or unrighteousness? If we're holding it in unrighteousness, then God's wrath is revealed against us. There's no excuse to hold it in unrighteousness, because that knowledge that he's made known to revealed to us, of his eternal power and Godhead, gives us an obligation. How do we hold the truth, that truth of him, that we have an eternally powerful Creator. How do we hold that truth in righteousness? Verse 21 says, because that which may be known of God, because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God. So how do we hold that truth in righteousness? We must glorify Him as God. If we don't, then how are we holding the truth? And that's in unrighteousness. That's when God's wrath is revealed against us. Is there any excuse for not glorifying God as God when we know we have a God? This says we all know we have a maker. We all know we have a creator. That means we belong to Him. He owns us. And that means we're obligated to seek Him and live for Him. When we get down to verse 25, these ones who will not glorify Him as God, they change the truth of God into a lie, and it says, and worshipped and served the creature, and that's the word for creation. Because there's the Creator, and then there's all that He made. And He says they worship and serve the creature, the creation. Now, it reads here in our King James Version, more than. But if we look at that Greek word para there, and it's in the case that is in, that preposition, with the case that it is in, it has the meaning literally alongside of, which is appropriate for what the context is. The problem isn't that mankind devotes himself or gives some whatever amount above 50% in loving and serving the creation instead of the Creator. If it really was a more than situation, then it's a matter of degrees. And then to be okay with God, then we got to make sure we got to find that we've got at least 50.00001% for God and 49.999 whatever to the loving and serving the creation. We would be in a situation like that where we could try to measure it out and make sure we give God just that little bit smidge more of our love and service over what we give to the world. It isn't more than. Alongside of. They worship and serve the creation alongside of the Creator. Now, with that language, what does that mean? How much of living for this world and loving it is in keeping with glorifying God as God? That's a big zero. We can't worship and serve the creation alongside of the Creator at all. That's the point. That's what he says. That fits in with everything else we read in God's Word. Matthew chapter 4, verses 8 through 10. And we're going to have to close after this one. But Matthew 4, 8 through 10. When the devil was tempting Christ, it says, again, the devil taking him up into an exceeding high mountain and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, and saith unto him, all these things will I give thee if thou wilt fall down and worship me. Then said Jesus unto him, get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. Now, by Christ's own words, how much of our service belongs to God? 100%. Only. He uses that word right there. We are to only serve God in our lives. That means zero for the creation. We can't love the world and love God. Didn't we read that in 1 John 2:15? If we love the world, the love of the Father is not in us. It's not a matter of degree. It's one or the other, either or. We either love God or we love the world. We're either a friend of the world and God's enemy, or we become God's, the Lord's friend, and will be hated by the world and be the world's enemy. That's the choice. It's an either or. And we're out of time. So Lord willing, we'll look at a little bit more on this in verse 4 before we continue on. The context will continue from there too. So we'll try to study this some more in our time next Wednesday night, the Lord willing.